Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us today. We've got an interesting show coming up. As usual, we're going to be following the money, in this case, your money, or if you're a furloughed federal worker, maybe your lack of money. My first guest is Jessica Clement. She is with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Before that, Jessica was legislative director for the Federal Managers Association, and before that, she worked on Capitol Hill, so she has experience at just about every level, and we're delighted to have you with us, Jessica.
Thank you, Mike, for having me.
Hey, listen, you keep getting promotions. What is your title at NARF?
It's legislative director.
Legislative director. Okay, let's cover the waterfront there. Hey, lots of questions. I mean, obviously we're into sequestration. We have the shutdown. The debt ceiling limit is looming. They may take action by tomorrow, which is the deadline the Treasury has set. But some closer to home questions, some more realistic things for federal retirees in particular. First off, what about the cost of living adjustment? A, are people going to get the COLA for the month of October?
You just listed a laundry list of issues as it relates to the federal community over at NARF. We're calling it Feds in Crisis. But let's start with the COLA. On October 9th, the Department of Labor announced that it will not be able to release the September figures as it relates to the cost of living. The September figures are the last month used to calculate what the cost of living adjustment for next year will be. That number, that percentage, impacts federal retirees, Social Security recipients, anyone on disability, veterans disability benefits, et cetera. So they can't do the September numbers yet because the people who do these types of things are furloughed. So without the September numbers, you can't tell us what the COLA is going to be for next year. So the COLA announcement is inevitably delayed until when? Probably won't know until they're able to go back to work.
In the in August, I looked on your website and I saw the Consumer Price Index. In August, the COLA was 1.4%. The Associated Press over last weekend did their own calculations, and they estimated it would be 1.5%. But there's nothing official yet, right?
Nothing official yet. I think 1.5% is a very well-educated guess. I would say probably within 0.2 percentage points on either side.
Right, and earlier I said October. I meant November.
Right.
There's no danger, or is there, that people won't get a check or a deposit in November, is there?
Well, that's an interesting question. As it relates to the COLA, no, that wouldn't impact their check in November. As it relates to us getting very, very close to hitting the debt ceiling, if Congress cannot come to an agreement by the end of the day, before the markets open tomorrow morning, they still don't have an agreement by the end of the day tomorrow, it is incredibly likely that folks will not get their checks on November 1st.
Okay, and they've been saying that, too, with Social Security. They always
Absolutely.
Tell you on radio never to say the word Social Security because the phones light up. But I saw a piece in the Washington Post today, and someone said it is quite possible that Social Security checks would be delayed.
If we are in a situation where the debt limit is not raised in the next, I would go 24 hours, but we could maybe go a little bit further than that. But if the debt limit isn't raised, we are faced with a situation where the Treasury has to pick and choose which bills it is going to pay. And Social Security and federal annuities will probably not be among that very, very short list. Federal employee salaries as well. But if we're in a shutdown, if we're still in a shutdown, those salaries aren't being paid anyway. So that's an easier choice for the Treasury.
Got an interesting email here from Robert, who's with the Department of Justice, and he says, could you ask the appropriate guest on today's show, with the impending retirement tsunami of federal workers in early 2014, how they see the aspect of federal life playing out, personally as one intending to leave effective January 2014, because as a furloughed accepted type, I cannot get my annual leave above the cap. I had intended to work through April 20th, 2014, but between the hiring freeze and pay freeze and sequestration, and now the shutdown, there's no relief other than shutting the door and walking away. My superiors say that's not an option.
Well, if you're eligible to retire, you can choose the date that works for you. The NARF magazine, actually, for the month of November, the cover article was written by Tammy Flanagan, who is very well versed in these issues, on the articles about picking the best retirement date for you. I would strongly encourage the person who wrote you to take a look at that article. You have to figure out what works best for you, and perhaps what works best for the person who wrote in is not what works best for his colleagues. But I think there is a general sentiment among the active federal employees right now that why am I sticking around? You know, if I'm eligible to retire, I've been under a 3-year pay freeze. I've suffered, you know, maybe 10 days of furloughs this year, maybe six, maybe one. Why should I stay? And I think that is a very, very valid sentiment.
I've heard from a number of people that the only reason they're not retiring is because there's so many people in the retirement pipeline already, and they don't want to get caught up in that waiting 6, 8, 12 months before they get a full annuity check.
It's a very good point. OPM has a backlog of their retirement claims right now. They're getting better, but it's not, you know, it's not where it needs to be yet. I think they said March of 2014 is when they anticipate the backlog being gone. But you're right. Some retirees have had to wait 6, 8, 12 months to get their first full annuity check. And some people may not be able to do that for 6, 8 months, which does delay retirement.
You mentioned the NARF magazine, and full disclosure, I am a NARF member, so I get it at the office, but it is for members only. But I heard, and I hope I'm not putting you into a corner here, that NARF was about to launch or had launched a trial membership program.
We have. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to talk about that. Last week, NARF launched a promotion offering 6 months free to active federal employees. You know, we're of the position that we need to all come together, have our voice heard in the halls of Congress. We are getting calls upon calls from NARF members and non-NARF members alike, active federal employees. When can I go back to work? When am I going to get paid? Is the shutdown going to end anytime soon? And the stronger your collective voice is, the louder you will be heard in the halls of Congress. With that 6 month free membership, you will get all the benefits of NARF membership, the NARF magazine, emails we send out, access to our Legislative Action Center. We do a weekly hotline on Fridays. You get all the benefits, and you can decide at the end of that 6 months if this is something you want to stick with.
Yeah, I would think it's worth it for the magazine alone, but then they have access to your website and special member questions and your legislative operation and that sort of thing. Also, I would point out here that as a NARF member, I'm also a member of the AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild, here on radio. And I can tell you the dues structure of the federal unions, whether it be AFGE, NTEU, and FFE, Federal Managers Home, is extremely nice compared to that in the private sector. I think my dues are something like $150 a month, and that would buy you several memberships in NARF, I believe.
It would, in fact, buy you several memberships in NARF. Our due structure is very low. It is $40 for your first year of membership.
Yeah, okay. Now, I know you've been hearing from people because NARF, it is the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, emphasis on active as well as retired. Then these are people who are interested in preserving the retirement system. Have you been hearing from a lot of people about the shutdown?
Absolutely. We are hearing from a lot of people, retired, active contractors, et cetera. They are in limbo right now, and they do not know when the next time they are going to get paid.
My son-in-law is a government contractor, and he has been furloughed, and he has been told he will not get paid again. I guess it's still up in the air. I would bet it'll happen for federal workers.
I think it probably will happen for federal workers. I'm of the mindset I don't like to, you know, bank on anything. You know, if I was a federal employee right now, I'd probably be a little, you know, furloughed or not, I'd probably be a little stingier with my money. The bill to provide back pay to furloughed federal employees passed the House unanimously by a vote of 407-0. I think that's very telling. I think whatever CR or grand deal or whatever bargain the Senate, where the bill seems to be right now, works out, will probably provide that back pay. The bill that the House was set to vote on yesterday, then ultimately got pulled, did provide back pay to furloughed federal workers. I am optimistic that this will eventually happen, but I'm also of the mindset, you know, never say never.
Yeah,
I know with this Congress, I never want to bank on anything until it actually happens.
You've been on there. Yeah, a vote of 407 to nothing normally would be a good thing, but with this group, you don't know. I wanted to ask you about the chain CPI when we come back, but our producer, Lauren Larson, is preparing some Halloween music because the chain CPI, I know, is the ultimate horror story for federal workers. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio, federalnewsradio.com. Hey, Welcome back to your turn. Mike Causey here. We're going to be talking with Sean Riley. Sean is a senior writer for the Federal Times and a frequent visitor. Sean, you with us?
I'm here, Mike. How are you?
I don't know how you have time to relax and be able to do this. Thank you for taking out. Have you ever been in a more confusing situation?
No, I don't think the word chaos does it justice. It seems like it really changes, at least in the last day or two. It seems like things have changed almost hour by hour. At the moment, the situation for, getting an increase in the debt ceiling through and simultaneously putting federal employees back to work looks a little more positive than it did 12 hours ago, but it's still a very uncertain situation.
Do you find it interesting that the Republicans are buying from the media and the public and the polls are getting the blame for the shutdown, right or wrong? The numbers are there in every poll I've seen, and yet it was a Republican initiative, or largely a Republican initiative in the House that produce this legislation to give furloughed federal workers the back pay.
Well, I think that speaks to the fact that Republicans, members of Congress, many of them have significant numbers of federal employees in their districts, particularly with military installations. There's a quite conservative congressman, Representative Doug Lamborn from Colorado, who represents Fort Carson out there, and I think an Air Force base as well. He introduced a bill earlier this month that would not only give furloughed federal employees back pay, it would ensure that if there's another shutdown this year, that even furloughed employees would be paid in a timely manner, and they would not need additional authorization from Congress to do it. So I think they're responding to political pressure. I think they also know that they're taking some heat. Concern you hear, or one objection you hear frequently, at least from federal employees, is that they're being kept from doing their jobs because Congress won't do its job by passing a budget to reopen the government. So I think it's pretty clear they're sensitive to that.
Well, I think a lot of people, politicians included, are confused about the location and the influence of the federal workforce. Now, when you say federal bureaucracy, most people think of Washington, D.C., maybe include inside the Beltway area, which in fact we have 14% to 15% of the federal population. Now, that's great. It's a lot of people, and it's good for us. It's good for business. It creates jobs. It's a steady flow of money, except for times like now. But when you get into other communities, you mentioned Utah, Ogden, Utah, primary employer out there is Hill Air Force Base, the IRS, and the Forest Service. Take those three away, and there's not much going on. This happens in Huntsville, Alabama, towns in Arkansas, districts in New Mexico. Alaska has a huge federal employee population, considering its total population. And so you think that congressmen are feeling the grassroots heat from this?
Oh, I think absolutely. When you take, as you noted, I mean, many of these installations or federal facilities are in relatively rural or remote areas where there's not, not significant sources of other employment, or at least not that pay as well or have the same kind of benefit package. And given that people often live fairly close to the line, even missing one or two paychecks can really be financially devastating.
I was thinking about this effort to get back pay for furloughed feds, and you recall during the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, pay was the issue. Neither President Clinton nor President Bush proposed full raises for federal workers. They proposed zero in the case of President Clinton, or much smaller raises. And in every case, a coalition of mainly Washington-based legislators, people from the House and Senate, but primarily the House, would get together. If the president was a Democrat, then Steny Hoyer would lead the charge. If the president was a Republican, it would be Tom Davis or Frank Wolf, Republicans from Virginia, who would lead the charge. But they would get together and do an end run around the president and get federal workers a better pay raise, I think, every year in each of 8 years but one. And I noticed yesterday the other day that this effort to get back pay for the furloughed federal workers came from Jim Moran, a Democrat from Virginia, and Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia. Do you think that coalition may revive at some point?
Well, I think it certainly has in this case. I think in regard to being able to muster enough support for an across-the-board pay increase, What you're describing back when, say, Congressman Davis was still on the Hill, that seems like a different era.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the budget was in much better shape, and it, you know, we're now in the ending, nearing the end of a third year of a federal freeze on federal pay scales, and it looks like we could be heading into a fourth. So I don't think the support is there necessarily to push through an across-the-board increase next year. I think there are increasing questions being raised about how much longer they can continue to do this, you know, to freeze pay year after year. But particularly with, you know, Congress Moran being in the minority at this point and Republicans not being terribly sympathetic to federal employees overall, it seems dubious or doubtful at this time.
Yeah. The Jessica Clement from NARF was talking about the grand design or a grand plan, and she's saying she believes this will pop up after after we get this current thing settled, you know, when they kick the can down the road, decide to settle the deficit spending limit when they decide to increase that, mm-hmm. the borrowing limit. And she thinks that part of the grand design, one of the things that's going to come up is one of the usual suspects, and that is the chained CPI. What do you think of that?
I think it's a very, I think she's right. This is an area where, one of the few areas, I think, where there's significant agreement on potential savings between the Obama administration and Republican members of Congress. You know, the administration included the chained CPI in its FY14 budget request. By its count, it would save, and this is used to calculate everything from COLAs for everything from federal employees, pensions to Social Security, retiree benefit increases. By the administration's estimate, it would save $230 billion over 10 years, which is a significant amount of money. Now, you already have NARF and other organizations representing retirees across the board objecting to this because it would mean less, it would mean essentially smaller cost of living adjustments in years to come. But again, I think there's, given the lack of agreement between the administration and congressional Republicans in other areas, such as on raising taxes, this would be relatively low-hanging fruit. And I know there's some employee advocates who expect it to be included in any kind of, you know, larger bargain over reducing the deficit.
Right. And while we focus on the federal side of it here, the big savings would come in Social Security. I think one out of every six Americans gets it. Mm-hmm. But you would have future cost of living adjustments for federal retirees, people, military retirees, people who get military retired pay, and people who get Social Security, an awful lot of people, and theirs would be reduced, I think, according to Jessica's calculations, 0.3% each year, a small amount, an insignificant amount at the beginning, but when you're talking about the administration estimating it to save $230 billion with a B, over 10 years, if that's the savings to the government, to the taxpayer, then that means that's also the price tag to retirees, correct?
Exactly. But I think the political appeal of this is that it does not involve taking away something from recipients that they already enjoy. It means reducing the amount of future increases, but they're not going to see necessarily, unless they're, you know, particularly attuned to this issue, see that they're or perceive that they're getting less than they might have otherwise received under the standard consumer price index.
Yeah, this is a case of, with the chain CPI, you don't know what you don't know.
Precisely.
You don't know what's going to happen. Got an email here, which I'm looking for even as we speak, but someone wanted me to ask you about the possibility of buyouts coming up with all of this other stuff that's going on. We don't think of anything good happening, but you think buyouts, because, you know, defense recently was talking about layoffs, not just furloughs, but they were talking about layoffs.
Yeah, I think they're already going on. I mean, the agencies often don't announce them, and OPM doesn't the Office of Personnel Management does not publicize them. But, for example, I heard from one union official that at least some parts of the Defense Logistics Agency are offering, you know, buyouts and early, the early retirement option. You know, the Defense Department, according to the Comptroller Robert Hale, will be instituting reductions in force this year, I think, regardless of what happens in Congress. And often as a way of reducing or minimizing the impact of a RIF, agencies will offer buyouts and retirements, early retirement packages, to get people to leave voluntarily. So I think it's already happening. The question is whether the pace will pick up and also whether, you know, they'll become more agencies will seek to make use of them.
Back in the day, which not that long ago, agencies did a pretty good job, and we had buyout trackers, and I know you guys did. But now, they, as you point out, they seem to be keeping it close to the vest. Is there a reason for that, or are they just preoccupied?
I'm honestly not sure. You know, OPM would be the logical place to for that information to be centralized, and they do keep track of it, but they essentially consider it to be private or not, you know, non-public information is what they've told us. I think in some cases agencies may be sensitive to discouraging or potentially discouraging people from applying for work there if they think that the agency is in the process of downsizing. You know, it could be seen as an indication that, you know, their budgets aren't doing as well as they would like. I think there are a number of reasons why agencies would prefer to keep that information under wraps, at least in some cases.
John, as we know, the Merit Systems Protection Board, tiny, tiny federal agency, which could probably meet in a everybody on the staff could meet in a very small building, their nationwide staff. They have been swamped with complaints, petitions from people who were furloughed, and this is going back some weeks and months now, that were furloughed. Now apparently they're going to get slammed again with people who have been locked out, if you will, by this shutdown. How are they coping, or can they cope?
Well, we don't know because they're all furloughed themselves right now.
Yeah.
I sent the clerk an email, you know, basically one of the top administrator an email a week or so ago, and, you know, got a bounce back message essentially saying, you know, I'm out until further notice and can't respond to your message. I mean they have an enormous workload already. I think the total number of appeals of sequester related furloughs is over 32,000, most of them from Defense Department employees. You know, that's on top of their regular workload, which is about 5,000 or 6,000 appeals of, from other sources. I don't know how many they might be anticipating from this. I'm not sure that the federal employee unions, which were instrumental in encouraging employees to file sequester-related furlough appeals, whether they're mounting a similar effort this time in regard to what's happened in this instance, because this was driven by Congress, not by agency decisions to furlough people.
Well, it looks as if the people, I think one of the few areas where you can make a complaint to the MSP in a case like this is alleging some kind of discrimination, you know, based on race, sex, ethnicity, what have you. And it would be one thing to do it under sequestration, but it seems to me it would be another to do it under this current lockout or furlough system because of the people who make the decisions as to who's exempt and who's not exempt, that it would be easier perhaps to make a case for discrimination.
Possibly. As I said, you raise a great question, and I don't know how things shook out after the 95-96 shutdown. That'd certainly be something worth worth exploring. There definitely could be appeals of, I assume, of from employees who were declared non-accepted or non-essential, as the term is often used. But how widespread those are, you know, given that the MSPB is shut down at this point, I think it's hard to gauge.
Yeah, it's become a politically correct thing, but we need to take a short break here. I'll be right back talking with Sean Riley from the Federal Times here on Federal News Radio, federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. I'm talking with Sean Riley. He is a senior writer with the Federal Times, and we've been commiserating about trying to keep track of all this stuff, and they do seem to get complicated. Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know there are a lot of reasons for this shutdown, an effort to defund or at least derail or slow down the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And but it seems like the goal has shifted, the target keeps moving, and things have changed. Was this ever about saving money?
Not directly. I suppose you could say that from the Republican perspective, they are concerned that the Affordable Care Act will cost the government money in terms of, for example, subsidies that will be paid to lower-income folks who qualify, for subsidies to purchase health insurance. I think the bigger concern among those in the Republican Party and the Republicans in Congress who promoted this approach, you know, defunding, attempting to defund implementation of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, was concerned that this essentially represented a massive expansion of government into people's lives by, for example, requiring them to buy health insurance as opposed to, you know, waiting until they got sick and going to the emergency room. So I don't think directly, no, I don't think I really, looking back on the debate over the last couple of weeks, I don't think that really was the primary, saving money was the primary issue.
Because it seems to me during the shutdown, the last great shutdown of the winter of 95-96, that at the end of the event, the Congressional Research Service did a sort of an after-action look at it, and they estimated that the shutdown, in fact, cost the government, seems to me it was in the neighborhood of $300 million, and that was in 1995-96. But when you look at the loss of revenue, you have Internal Revenue people who normally bring in $16,000 to $20,000 to $40,000 a day. They're not working. They're not bringing it in, and a lot of IRS operations have been shut down. Don't try to not pay your taxes, but that things like refunds are not going out, and many of the revenue generating or revenue collecting portions of government are not collecting any revenue.
That's right. I mean, and there was a firm, IHS Global Insight, which in late September, before the shutdown actually started, they put out an estimate based on sort of the average value of a federal pay and benefits package that put the loss, the impact, the economic impact, about $1.6 billion a week. Now, that will have dropped because the Defense Department, as you know, has recalled most of its employees who had been furloughed back to work. But there's no question that if you look at, you know, presuming that Congress does agree to back pay for federal employees, you'll have been giving an awful lot of people essentially a paid vacation, not one that they asked for, but that's, but one that they'll have received nonetheless. And I think there's an incalculable loss in terms of productivity. I talked to somebody who had been through, who was a manager during the 95-96 shutdowns earlier this morning, and he mentioned that it took basically a week or so after the shutdown ended to get people sort of back on an even keel, kind of focused on their jobs, et cetera, as opposed to worrying about, you know, whether they were going to be paid or not. So I think there's going to be, you know, there's I hope that OMB or the Government Accountability Office, somebody will take a look and try and quantify what those costs have been.
Yeah, and of course there's no way you can put a price tag on morale or lack of same, but you wonder what's going to be the attitude when the people who were forced to stay home, turns out they're on paid vacation, albeit late pay, mm-hmm. but they're on paid vacations, and when they go back into the office and meet their colleagues who have been there all along, who are not going to be paid anything extra for being exempt or essential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got an email last night from someone who has been furloughed and expressing a lot of frustration about the fact that in some agencies he would have been considered essential and would have been going to work. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about that. I think there's a lot of unhappiness with Congress in general and a feeling that this shutdown was really, you know, that essentially federal employees were collateral damage in this shutdown, perhaps more so than back in 95-96. We've heard a lot of talk about the possibility of federal employees finally retiring. Now,
yeah.
Whether that comes to pass or not.
So may push it out. Well, Sean, thank you so much for being with us again, and thanks to Lauren Larson for running the show. Remember, where our shows are archived here on our homepage, so if you want to hear this one or any previous shows, you can just go on our homepage. Have a good week. We'll see you next week.